Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's typically late health science and energy show, co-hosted with Bella Bird and Steve Barish. We're just now getting up the Ustream up for everybody, as I know that. And Steve, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing real good, Fred. I have a lot to tell you about the new necklace that I've been wearing. So,
okay, great. Let me just get the broadcast up and running here.
Not a problem.
Yeah, and come on, allow. I want everything we say to be recorded. There we go. I think we are on the air. Okay, now go ahead.
Yeah, the platinum projector that I've been wearing, I've just been wearing that for the last 2 weeks. And
okay,
Monday night.
Keep going. I've got to turn the sound down on here now.
Sure.
Keep going. I've got to turn the sound down.
You know how we are here with everything. There we go. All right. Yeah,
Monday
sorry,
night.
Everybody. We're late. I've been working on this book, and I lose every day almost working on the book.
Right. Well,
it's
I know
really
you're
important. I'll read some of it tonight. So go ahead. Tell us about what's going on.
Monday night, the Andromedans came to me around 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night.
Right.
And they told me to go inside the necklace, inside the pendant itself, which
right.
I did, and I meditated in the center.
And just let everybody know that's called micro psi vision when you do that.
Micro psi vision?
Micro psi vision. That's what Annie Besant and Charles Ledbetter did.
Yes, yes.
They were visiting the atom back at 1899 and 1901, back in
right.
that time period.
Right.
And the scientific community actually gave them credibility for what they did because it tied in their numbers, tied in with the atomic weights and the atomic numbers of the first 69 elements on the periodic chart.
Right, right.
Go ahead. So now what happened?
So now what happened? The Andromedans came to me. I was meditating inside the projector for 4 hours.
Right.
I went right into the center, and the more I got to the center, the brighter the projector came.
Right.
And I was there for 4 hours, and the Andromedans talked to me through the whole time.
Wow.
And they were really, really very interesting to talk to. And what they were doing was have me very, very centered and steadied right in the center of the projector. And I could see it felt like 360 degrees.
Right.
And it was really, really beautiful. And I just stayed there. That's exactly where they want me to be. They said, be silent, be still. That's what I did. And the light was incredible. So the following day when I was working with my clients, the energy was so powerful that people were saying, my goodness, what's going on with you? And I told them the story about the projector. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay. And what happened was the following day I was working with my clients, and we had a great time with the necklace. I think
right.
somebody's beeping us.
It might just be the it just might be these different computers that I've got on.
Okay. So anyhow, the following day, as I was working, we did a tremendous amount of work with the projector, and it really showed us the way of doing things even a little bit more. What I was doing is that my third eye was even a lot more powerful than it was the day before, and I was actually in the projector working with people and actually in my third eye and the projector all at the same time. The energy of it is absolutely incredible. So it's different than gold. It's different than silver. It's just very advanced. It's something that I've never even in my wildest dreams thought it would be.
Well,
and
platinum itself, the metal, you know, is it's a very, very exotic metal.
Okay.
It has very high energy frequencies that it generates into the central nervous system, primarily the 10th cranial nerve of the brain, which is also called the parapsychic, parasympathetic nervous network, or the psychic aerial of the body.
Okay.
So it's you're carrying a real load there with that thing.
Right. So it seems like wearing this necklace has increased my energy 1,000-fold at least.
The people really like it then.
Yes, they were actually feeling a lot more energy coming from me. And what it was is it was smooth, it was sweet. Usually my energy is smooth and sweet, but it's a lot more, tremendously a lot more. And the following night on Tuesday, they asked me to go through the projector again. And what happened was I went to the front of the projector. I was actually looking out the projector, looking past the diamonds, looking past the gold, and able to see outside the projector from the inside of the projector.
Wow.
And it was really incredible. I mean, the energy is actually soft, but the voice is very gentle with me. And I was able to do that because the voice was telling me, just be silent, be still, you know, go further in. And the next thing I knew, I was looking out the front of the projector.
Oh, that's pretty good. So you were inside looking out.
I was inside looking out.
Yeah. Now
it became a liquid form. It was quite interesting to see, Fred.
Yeah, that's kind of like Tesla energy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some of the stuff that he was doing in the very end there.
Right,
which I
right,
wrote about in my book. I didn't read that section on Nikola Tesla. The people have to get the book to read it. But
right,
there's a big section in there where he was having these kinds of experiences.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage to go into a necklace you've never been in before.
Yeah,
and that's when the Andromedans were very very strong but very sweet with me, and told me just to stay right in the center, which I did for 4 hours.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really wild. I wasn't tired. I wasn't anything. I was just entranced or something of that nature. And the energy of it, Fred, was so bright white light. I mean, it was just unbelievable power. Unbelievable power. I'll tell you, it humbles you.
Yeah, though these things will do that, you know, because you're susceptible to an energy that's beyond your own. I mean, all energy is connected, but there is an individuality that the universe gives us, you know?
Right, right, right.
That's our right to make mistakes. You know,
yes.
If we just stay with the energy, we wouldn't even have to live on this planet. But everybody has to have time to make a mistake, so
right,
we're given
right,
our free,
right.
What you call free will.
But I've never, as long as I've been wearing these projectors, and I started with the silver, went to the gold, I was never I was inside the gold necklace.
Right.
Looking out. Remember, I told you I could see out the back of the nuclear receptor. But this is the first with the projector, and it was extremely, extremely powerful experience.
Wow.
Very powerful. The most powerful, almost probably the most powerful experience I've ever had, with the exception of the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, I was seeing the Ark of the Covenant for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And I had a friend of mine, Mary, who's a great psychic here in the city. And the Ark was down at the other end of the table. And
yeah,
it appeared right in front of us. And I said, Mary, can you see what I see at the other end of the table? And she said, yes, it was the Ark of the Covenant. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, she saw it, too.
She saw it, too. And
yeah,
after that, I think about 6 months later, the Ark showed up again. And I was looking straight at it, and the Ark cover came off. And I was allowed to go into the Ark.
Oh,
and
that's
I was
pretty
in
good.
There
you didn't get electrocuted.
I was in there for about 30 days.
Oh, and, that's pretty good.
It's really interesting because it's a whole different universe.
Oh, yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah, so it's extremely high. I got lost in there, but I wasn't really afraid. I asked God, I said, how do I get out of here? And he said, look up. And I looked up and I said, oh. So that was my way out. But the interesting part of the Ark is that it was so beautiful inside. I mean, I was so peaceful. Why I was given that, I have no idea, but it was extremely peaceful. And It was gorgeous inside, just absolutely gorgeous.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, really, really cool stuff in there. I saw tremendous light in there. I saw, it was just wonderful. And I was told what to do inside when I was inside. So there's a lot that's going on in that arc, so it does exist.
Got to get my sidekick back up here. She's crawling down my back. She's been doing some unusual things. You know, this is a time of year when birds breed, and she'll eventually... Mm-hmm. I'd like to breed this bird, you know.
Well, the other bird's young, isn't he?
Yeah, the other one's young. He'll be a year old on May 23rd. Yeah, May 23rd. This bird's an eclectus. They're very exotic. They're a very intelligent bird. And she knows she's on TV because she's looking at herself on the monitor. And when I say, we're going to go do the show, she jumps out of her house.
Wow.
Just jumps out.
Wow.
But lately her and her husband, you know, although he's kind of young yet, you know.
Yeah.
Been working with me down here in the studio in the morning writing my book. They have a little stand that they... up on the shoulder? Yeah, it's going on the shoulder now. That they stay on. But she jumps off the stand and goes into one of my equipment consoles, which is about, I'd say 7 feet tall, maybe 6.5 feet tall, that I do my Saturday show on. It's a whole equipment over there. I'll have to get a camera where I can point it around, rather than a fixed camera.
Mm-hmm.
And so she goes in there now, and she thinks... She thinks that it's a tree, because these birds, what they do is they'll go into a tree, and when they go inside of a tree, they will stay in there sometimes for a year. You know, inside of a dark tree, raising their babies.
Wow.
Yeah, and so what happens is, she's about 3 years old now, so I think that she's getting that call. And normally she's in a great big cage, which we call a house. It's beautiful. It's a very large cage. It's almost like an aviary that she hangs out in, or she just, you know, runs around the house on different stands. So she's out most of the time.
Right.
So it's all of a sudden now she goes into this cave. And what happens is the male bird, the green one, he's not able to stay on my shoulder yet. You know, he's too young, and he'll jump all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't been potty trained. She's potty trained. And so he will, you know, eventually, if he were older, he would fly around the woods. And what he would do is he would gather the food, chew it up, and then give it to her. And she would chew it up some more and then give it to the babies. That's what's happening.
Right.
So what happens is when she's a very gentle bird, but when she goes into her house, you know, her make-believe mating ground, raising babies house.
Right.
She turns into a protective bird, and she'll bite the shit out of you if you stick your hand in there. You have to let her come out when she wants to come out on her own.
Gotcha.
And so it's interesting to see how, and she bit Mikkel the other day really hard, because Mikkel stuck her hand in there to get her out, and she wouldn't want to come out.
Now, if
she's in her house or something, in her cage, she doesn't do that. But if it's a dark little place where she goes, give me a kiss right now, see?
Nice.
She's a different, she just switches. And when you raise parrots, that's one of the things about parrots. They can be the gentlest things, but, you know, they tell you, they'll give you warning signs, and she'll give you a look, and if you don't acknowledge the look, she's going to give you a bite.
Okay, gotcha. Now, which one had the hurt leg?
That was her husband.
That was the male, right?
Yeah, he lost a little piece of the tip of it where his nail was.
Uh-huh.
But he's all back to normal health again now. He's in fine shape.
That's great.
Maybe I'll have him on. Well, next week we probably won't do a show because we're going to be gearing up. We'll be probably up in L.A. next week.
Yeah.
But, so I guess you'll fly into the shows in Los Angeles. You can fly into LAX.
LAX? Is that closer than the John Wayne?
Yeah, John Wayne's about 40 miles away, and LAX
can
walk to the hotel, because the hotel is at LAX.
Okay, great.
Unless you want to fly into San Diego and come up here.
No, I don't want to do that.
Guest house or something, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what's happening.
Okay.
So what other kind of things did you do this week?
Just been doing a lot of work, Fred. Actually, I've been working too hard, so I got to back off a little bit. I'm still doing a lot of massages, and I'm really getting tired. So
it'd be nice
having a trip out to California, huh?
I'm writing on this book. It's only 5 years late, right?
Yeah.
About 5 years late.
Well, did you want to talk about that a little bit tonight?
Because yeah, I'm getting ready to here. And so, you know, this book is in, you know, several sections, and I'm winding down the science section. Remember, we last week we talked about
yes.
Max Planck.
Yes.
Well, after that, we did Tom Edison. We did. We're doing Einstein now in that chapter. We did Tom Edison and Nikola Tesla. We did him. Einstein's going to be quite a big section because he did so much.
Right.
Interesting, fabulous guy. And if you ever get a chance to go on the internet, listen to some of his old speeches. Okay, so now where I'm at is where we're at right now is that we're in a chapter that's about that lays the groundwork. The other chapter we were reading was laying the groundwork out for the receptor and the projector
right.
and all of the quantum science.
Right.
All the science, Richard Feynman will be covered, David Bohm will be covered. All the guys from the 20th century, and now we're in the 21st century, so, you know, there's not too much going on here other than Michio Kaku and Leonard Susskind, which I'm going to try to get interviews out of them for the book at the very end when I'm done with it. So now we're in another section, and we're going into the relationship between pharmaceutical companies, drug stores, you know, and mind control. Okay?
Right.
That's where we're at now. So I'm going to read a little bit of it. Probably
yeah.
has a lot of mistakes. But the nice thing about it is it's, I don't know, there's a lot of pages here. Can't believe I read this. I wrote this much.
Mm.
A few days worth of writing. Get up here. Okay, this chapter hasn't got a name yet, but it's something like drugs, drug companies, health, manipulation, deception, power, and mind control.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The earliest drug stores date back to the Middle Ages. The first known drug store was opened by Arab pharmacists in Baghdad in 754. Now, isn't that interesting? You know, the Tower of Babel was built in Baghdad. The
mm-hmm.
tribes of Israel split out of Baghdad. I mean, the Garden of Eden was supposedly located there at some point.
Right.
It all comes from there. And of course, that's Iraq. Soon, many more drug stores began operating throughout the medieval Islamic world and eventually moved to medieval Europe by the 19th century. Many of the drug stores in Europe and North America eventually developed into a large pharmaceutical companies. Most of today's pharmaceutical companies were founded in the late 19th and 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Key discoveries were made in the 1920s and 30s, such as insulin, penicillin, and then became mass manufactured. Switzerland, Germany, and Italy were the most recognized manufacturers, followed by the United Kingdom, U.S., Belgium, and Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The homeopathic world, which is our world, and the allopathic world split around the time that Louis Pasteur, and he lived from 1822 to 1895, discovered penicillin, which was a pharmaceutical, and Samuel Hahnemann, April 10, 1755 to July of 1843, popularized homeopathic natural remedies. Legislation was acted upon to test and approve drugs to require appropriate labeling. Prescription and non-prescription drugs became legally distinguished from one another as the pharmaceutical industry matured.
Mm-hmm.
The industry got underway in earnest from the 1950s in the development of systematic scientific approaches, understanding human biology, and sophisticated manufacturing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, numerous new drugs were developed during the 1950s and mass-produced and marketed through the 1960s.
Right.
These included the first oral contraceptive called the pill, cortisone, blood pressure drugs, and other heart medications, MAO inhibitors, that's monoamino oxidase inhibitors, SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, drugs, and finally, Thorazine. Havadol and other tranquilizers brought upon the age of psychiatric medication. Valium, which was called diazepam, discovered in 1960. It was marketed from 1963 and became the most rapidly enlarged prescribed drug in history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I became aware of mind control when I joined the U.S. Air Force in 1959 and participated in the special training programs. See, all this newer stuff, I was involved in it somehow.
Mm.
By 1960, I was stationed at the 776 Radar Aero Squadron at Point Arena Air Force Base in Northern California. Our jobs there were to protect the western part of the United States from any form of attack. This was during the height of the Cold War, so that our position was considered instrumental in global defense. Our radar mainly consisted of an ANFPS 35 search set that looked out over the ocean over 400 miles, and an ANFPS 28 height set that looked at how high an object was.
Mm-hmm.
Information was then fed over to the Strategic Air Command Headquarters, SAC, located at Beale Air Force Base, also nearby in Northern California. If we sensed a threat, we would send out our interceptor aircraft to check it out. Now, that was quite a life I was living then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty wild. I was riding my Triumph motorcycle, one like I've got in the garage here now, like a madman, and doing this highly classified stuff and being able to scramble jets. How would you like to be able to make a phone call and you got jets going out?
That's
I had that power.
Wow.
It's a power, I don't know. One of the first things I noticed that was very often, late descending night, we would observe objects coming from outer space descending at the rate of 20,000 miles per hour at an approximate altitude of 5,000 feet, taking a horizontal path in the direction of Mexico and about 5,000 miles an hour. So they come down 20,000 miles an hour, make left-hand turn, because we're looking out the ocean, and they head down to Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah. These observations were made on a planned position indicator. Here. I've got lost my space here. Bird wants to be held. codependent helper here wanted to be held for a minute. Okay, now, here we go. Okay, these observations were made on a planned position indicator, PPI scope, and the operator, nicknamed Scope Dope, would fill out a classified government form, DDS-332, detailing the events. The PPI room was small with several operators, all operating on above top-secret clearances. Actually, they were called Crypto-1 clearances. I had a top secret.
Hmm.
As soon as they left the room, they handed the forms over to a senior tech sergeant whom often shredded the reports. This, to me, was a little over the top, as all our work was paid by U.S. taxpayers, which I was one and still am,
mm-hmm.
and they were never notified, and most of the information was destroyed. Some of it obviously was kept in files somewhere, but due to overwhelming rapidity of these observations, the reports were more status quo. This happened so much and so often, we didn't even scramble for them anymore.
Mm.
When I complained about it to the base commander, I didn't put his name in, Colonel Harry Bunting is his name, but I didn't put that in. I was told in no uncertain terms to absolutely forget what I saw. Those that could not heed these specific commands often would find themselves institutionalized at Letterman General Hospital, an Army base located at the Presidio of San Francisco. If you bitched about it, that's where you went.
Holy
what do you think man. Of that?
That's
now, doesn't that tell you, we're talking about mind control and my experience, you know, follow me?
Yes.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay. When I left the Air Force and went to work for North American Aviation, later known as Rockwell, and was assigned to NASA to work on the Saturn spacecraft, I found myself working for several scientists and their assistants that were formerly part of the Nazi Third Reich and had been brought over to America at the end of World War II under Operation Paperclip. Now think about that karma. My last life, I was part of the Third Reich. I was assassinated by Reinhard Heydrich for not cooperating with Hitler, although Hitler and I knew each other. And now here I am in this lifetime working with Wernher von Braun and his henchmen.
Wow.
Think of that.
That's wild.
Yeah. So anyhow, these guys came over. They were brought over to America at the end of World War II under Operation
mm-hmm.
Paperclip.
Mm-hmm.
Von Braun was the main director, but his henchmen, who I haven't put his name in here. I should put it in here, but I don't want to get a lawsuit, you know. His main henchmen, all from Germany, they all behaved like the Gestapo. So here I am, working for Rockwell, having lived in a past life in Germany. Mm-hmm. Now I'm in the Gestapo again, and I'm working for a U.S. company. It was karma all over the place, you know.
That's wild.
Yeah. So anyhow, once again, mind control and no individual thinking towards the project we were assigned to was the status quo. If anyone appeared to get out of hand, then they were threatened with breaching national security and some form of mental confinement. Can you believe that shit?
That's wild, Fred.
I complained about the Gestapo to one of my bosses over at Rockwell, who made my paycheck. We Rockwell employees were assigned to NASA. You worked at NASA, but you got your paycheck from Rockwell. If you complain to Rockwell, you know, you're breaching national security. Okay.
That's right.
I didn't realize it at the time, but later on, I learned a lot about this. Came from a dictates of a metal of a German company, IG Farben.
Oh boy.
Yeah. When I left NASA, I went out in the civilian sector as a consultant for many different types of scientific, medical, and engineering projects. In the next decade, until I started Pyridyne, I visited over 2,000 different companies. This I have well documented, including all of the related documents of the military and civilian companies I was involved with at my radio show network located in the archives at bbsradio.com. And if you go in there and look at my background, all those documents from those days when I worked at Lockheed Skunk Works, it's all there. My discharge from the Air Force and all that stuff's there. In 1976, when I started Pyridyne, I began lecturing what I have learned and saw the future. There would come a day when the entire world would fall under some form of one-world government control. Now, this is 1976.
Right.
Okay? I proceeded to get a Ph.D. in homeopathic medicine so that I could round out my knowledge. Mm-hmm. I began to develop anti-ELF devices and market them worldwide. As I began to study the effects of ELF, I noticed that a large part of the American public was given mind control drugs to calm them down. And what was really upsetting them was that ELF, their bodies, were exposed to on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Along with ELF, I found that man-made radiation from over 900 nuclear bomb tests had contaminated the drinking water worldwide. And there's a lot of mistakes in here because the machine doesn't dictate properly, so this is not proofed or anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, was causing the spread of cancer at an alarming rate. I then directed my studies at cancer research and quickly found out there were several very well-documented cures for cancer. But the pharmaceutical and medical societies did not want the news of a cure to get out to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
I began to see how this information is inaugurated into a society. Mm-hmm. I saw many people, often very qualified doctors, harassed and imprisoned for curing cancer and other diseases without using pharmaceuticals. So this is when I started to wake up. By now, I was able to market my devices into several clinics. That's the old Pyridyne line. We were doing Star Orbs and stuff. And universities worldwide. I began a lecture tour soon thereafter, and today I continue to do so. Now let's examine the facts with a little history. I became involved when I began to work in a clinic in Newport Beach in 1979, where I found out the greatest amount of drug prescribed was Valium and that the victim of the American housewife. I then began to look at the darker side of the drug industry and was astounded at what I found out to be the cold heart of a hidden financial empire whose motive was to control the populace of the world.
Mm-hmm.
As the curtain rises, the 20th century is a good beginning. So in other words, this was my wake-up call when working at Pyridyne, going into clinics, that taking people off of Valium, seeing what it did to them, seeing some of these women die, because Valium is a horrible drug to come off of, that was my wake-up call, and that was in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I'm explaining how I woke up so that others can maybe wake up, too, if they haven't already. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Several of the current drug companies today have their roots from a company called IG Farben. IG translates into Interstressengemeinschaft, or community of interest, or Gemeinschaft, I didn't pronounce that right. At the beginning of the 20th century, three major firms, BASF, and you'll see them all over on, you buy a tape or something in a store, mm-hmm. it says Basef or mm-hmm. a CD. Bayer, which is Bayer Aspirin, and Horst. All German companies dominated the world chemical industry in producing pharmaceuticals and synthetic mm-hmm. dyes.
Mm-hmm.
All three were major firms were also integrated into the production of essential raw materials, and then began in the areas of chemistry, such as pharmaceuticals, photographic film, agricultural chemicals, and electrochemical.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman of Bayer, that's the world's largest producer of aspirin, Carl Duisberg, came to the United States in the spring of 1903. There he visited large American trusts such as Standard Oil, U.S. Steel, International Paper, and Alcoa. After returning to Germany, he proposed a nationwide merger of pharmaceuticals and dye technologies with American interests. IG Farben was founded on December 25, 1925, as the brainchild of genius Harmon Schmitz, with a merger of six companies: Basef, Bayer, Horst, AFKA, Chemischfabrik, Gershein Electron, and Chemischfabrik Worm, and the IG Farben building headquarters for the conglomerate was located in Frankfurt am Main, Germany. It's Frankfurt, mm-hmm. Germany. In 1931, by 1938, the company had 200. So they set the building up in 31. In 1938, the company had 218,000 employees.
Incredible.
Can you imagine that? That's in 7 years. That's faster than the growth of the dot-com industry here.
Yep.
During its heyday, it was the fourth largest company in the world behind General Motors, U.S. Steel, and Standard Oil.
Mm.
Now, this is really going to hit home here in a minute. Okay, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Between 1927... Yeah, we're doing... Yeah, we're okay on time. Between 1927 and the beginning of World War II, IG Farben doubled in size due in great part to American assistance by bond issues, such as one for $30 million offered by the National City Bank. By 1939, IG Farben acquired a participation and managerial influence in some other 380 German firms and 500 foreign firms. If you look around today, you will see the same thing happening all over again as the one-world government marches the United States towards fascism. Large companies are buying all out small ones by the dozens. There are 2,000 cartel agreements. There were 2,000 cartel agreements between IG Farben and foreign firms, including Standard Oil of New Jersey, DuPont, Alcoa, Dow Chemical, and others in the United States. In the beginning of Hitler's rise to power, IG Farben contributed 400,000 Reichsmarks to Hitler's political slush fund. That's $40 million today.
It's incredible.
Yeah, in 1928, the American holdings of IG Farben, the Bayer Company, General Aniline Works, AFKA, and ANSCO, AFKA, by the way, anytime you buy printing paper, printing supplies, it's AFKA makes all that, and Winthrop Chemical Company were organized into a Swiss holding company, G. Chemec, or Chemec. In the following years, these American firms became the American IG Chemical Corporation, later named General Aniline and Film. Herman Schmitz now became president of American IG. During the war, Herman's brother, Dietrich A. Schmitz, became the American president of IG of America of 41. So this is the founder of the whole thing in the first place, has now got American holdings during World War II, and we're fighting our own selves financially. In 1929, Ivy Lee, firm of Ivy Lee and L.T. Ross, became public relations counsel for IG Farben in the United States. Previous to that, Mr. Lee had been the Rockefeller's public relations manager.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the directors of both the American and German IG Farben empire were from the Federal Reserve Bank, of New York, Charles Mitchell, Walter Teagle, and Paul Warburg. From Ford Motor Company, Edsel B. Ford and Carl Bosch. And from the Manhattan Bank, where you probably go to right now, Bank of Manhattan, now called the Chase Manhattan Bank, H.A. Metz and Paul Warburg. Again, it's fair to say Edsel Ford resigned after the war because of the legal unhealthiness. Now currently look at our current day present situation. The same Federal Reserve Board that supported the Nazi IG Farben won't account for a lot of money authorized by them to bail out several American banks and other industrial compounds today.
Wow.
This fact should be duly noted as a major part of the inside track. You see, are you understanding this?
Yes, I understand what you're saying.
It's scary. During the planning of the invasion of Czechoslovakia and Poland in World War II, IG Farben dictated and directed to Nazi officials which chemical plants should be secured and delivered to IG Farben. By this time, John D. Rockefeller's United States-based Standard Oil Company had formed a cartel with IG Farben. Mm. Although today IG Farben is not the largest company that it was, being diversified into several other companies and the original name drop, look how big business was then, so corrupted, just like business today on a scale that are likewise corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Then this is what happens next. IG Farben built a factory named Buna Chemical Plant for producing synthetic oil and rubber and from coal in Auschwitz, and also gasoline. Guess what we're building in this country right now? A plant that can synthesize coal into jet fuel for the aviation industry, which has a higher toxicity rate, okay?
Mm.
Okay, in Auschwitz, which was the beginning of the SS activity in camps in this location during the Holocaust. At its peak in 1944, the factory in Auschwitz made use of 83,000 slave laborers. One of the products manufactured at the time by IG Farben was pesticide Zykon B, which was used in the German Reich gas chambers.
That was in the
Now, here's Rockefeller.
Was it IG Farben that did that?
Yes.
Jesus.
Financed by the Federal Reserve Board over here.
God.
Oh, yeah, here we go. Heinrich Himmler, the chief of the SS, was the main director of the building of Auschwitz. Himmler delegated SS Major Karl Wolf, chief of his personal staff, to be a liaison officer between the SS and IG Farben. During a meeting with Heinrich Budischfisch, the manager of IG Farben's Auschwitz concentration camp gasoline plant, it was determined that IG Farben would pay the SS three Reichsmarks for each unskilled concentration camp inmate per day, four Reichsmarks for skilled inmates. Later, as the war progressed, the SS agreed to furnish children at 1.5 Reichsmarks per day as the course of inmates received nothing. So they got nothing. So they're all the Jewish, you know, your descendants are in there. The SS is paying IG Farben for them to make gasoline for German airplanes and tanks.
Yeah.
Now, how's that? Now let's talk corruption here. I just documented all this. At the end of the war, due to the severity of the war crimes committed by IG Farben, the company was so corrupt to not be allowed to exist any longer, and it was divided between the United States and Russia. During the Nuremberg trials, a United States military tribunal, 24 directors of IG Farben were indicted. 13 mm-hmm. were sentenced to prison terms between 1 and 8 years. Some of these indicted in the trial were subsequently made leaders of many postware companies, like drug companies today. I can name a few, which I will. Some of these indicted in the trial were two-thirds of the six companies that owned IG Farben are still in business today. They are Bayer, BASF, Agfa, and Horst. If you look carefully, you will see products from these companies everywhere. Now let's chart a psychological progression and blend it in with the pharmaceutical giants and their goals. So what I've done here is I've set up the stage for the other companies that I'm going to write about that are over here. There's a bunch of them, like Surly and Don Rumsfeld and his corruption, all that stuff. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's, you know, remember how they used to institutionalize people? Okay, that's where mind control started. I haven't gotten up in the book yet to the CIA and the satellites and all of that. But, by the way, there's Rockefeller money on the newer projects, which I haven't written about yet, but I know about, which I'm going to write about.
Mm-hmm.
Rockefeller money all through this stuff. It's amazing. And Federal Reserve money. Okay? Clifford Whittington Beers, a Yale University graduate developed an excessive fear of mental collapse subsequent to the death of a brother who died from epilepsy. He became suicidal and spent several years in a mental institution. He eventually recovered in 1909, 5 years after his release. He formed the U.S. Committee for Mental Hygiene and called for a network of mental hygiene societies worldwide. Then in 1916, John Dewey, a very well-known American psychologist and educational reformer, wrote that there is always the danger that increased personal, listen to this, there is always the danger that increased personal independence will decrease the social capacity of an individual. In other words, if you're, they want you to be an ant in an ant hive. It often makes an individual so insensitive in his relations to others as to develop an illusion of being really able to stand and act alone, an unnamed form of insanity responsible for a large part of the remedial suffering of the world. You get that?
Yes, I do.
If you're an individual and you're a detriment to society and you're causing a problem in the world.
Yeah.
John Dewey was a mixed case of idealism and pragmatism, and this was called pragmatism, by the way. In the doctrine of pragmatism, it's where an individual makes progress by repetition and logic. Okay? And that, of course, is the Republican Party. That's Dick Cheney, the way he thinks. Repetition and logic. America, we're at war with terrorists. America, we're protecting you. America, even though we don't, there's no terrorists in Iraq, we're going to attack Iraq in case terrorists show up. That's the way they think. Okay, and that's what happened. I'm just bringing it up to date. This will come up today, but I haven't gotten there yet. I'm showing the foundation of it. Okay?
Yep.
It often makes, the opposite of repetition and logic is spontaneity, whereby logic is removed and observation of action is the direction of cause. That's the way I am. That's the way you should be, you know. Mm-hmm. In 1935, Dewey, together with Albert Einstein, remember, he's in the other section there, Alvin Johnson, became members of the United States section of the Internationally Recommended Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Later, one of Einstein's closest friends, philosopher Bertrand Russell, was dismissed as a professor of philosophy at the College of New York in 1940, because he had liberal views at the time, one of which sex should be permitted before marriage. And he threw him out for that. John Dewey and Horace Kallian, a Harvard graduate in philosophy, were editors of the case against Russell. I remember when Lenny Bruce first started his version of being a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
The world was shocked by his vernacular at the time. But today, as in Russell's case, Lenny's humor and Bertrand's beliefs are commonplace.
Ooh.
I realize that Lenny Bruce was thrown in jail a lot of times for just saying, you know, four-letter words. Therefore, there has always been a delicate line between what is socially acceptable and what is punishable by social law. And that's where that chapter is at right now.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting, huh?
That's very interesting. You know, from what I understand, from what I've heard, is that during the end of World War II, and also in the middle of World War II, that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies that were there, we were told not to bomb them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's absolutely incredible. The Russians wanted to destroy everything. They wanted to flatten everything, just flatten Germany till there wasn't anything left.
Right.
And we were told not to do that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, Lawrence Rockefeller... and Nelson Rockefeller,
mm-hmm.
Actually, Lawrence was Nelson's what, son or grandson.
Mm-hmm.
He founded ITAC, which is another section of my book I haven't written yet. And ITAC became the leading company, which was one of my clients when I had my company Scopes Unlimited and EH Research. They were one of my clients that I sold electronic equipment to, and they were building spy cameras to originally replace the U-2, and later on, spy on everybody, which they use today, which is part of the Google community.
Right.
And I was there in the middle of that, but I didn't know what it was. I remember I would go to these funny little buildings and around the country, sometimes in New York, sometimes in Santa Ana, California, and this old rundown building I'd go into, And there'd be the most, this would be a building that's probably worth $100,000 for the whole compound, and they've got probably 3,000 or 4,000 square feet. And I'd go in there, it'd be $2 or $3 million worth of equipment, part of what I sold to them. Why? Because it was a CIA-run operation. They would set up all over the country in slum. They didn't do fancy compounds, you know, like you see today, like, you know, Burroughs or IBM fancy building. They had crappy old buildings, and they dressed floppy, and they did these coveted top-secret projects to spy on American Project Echelon. I've got all the names and everything. And Lawrence Rockefeller was one of the big financiers of that. So naturally, they wouldn't be bombing the Germans in certain areas.
Yeah.
You know, they just wanted to get Hitler out of the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's really incredible when you think of everything that happened.
Yeah, well, this book's called The Inside Track, and I'm going to show the world, you know, or whoever wants to read the book, you know, maybe 13 people will read it, but there are going to be some people out there that'll have, you know, from what I've written, it's going to be pretty obvious what's going on. It's not going to be a conspiracy theory. You know, everything that I see, like Alex Jones and all these guys that go on the Coast Network, Coast to Coast, I see it's all fragmented. And nobody has the real names, the real programs. They have pieces of it or rumors. I'm putting down the real names, the real pieces, because guess what? From 1959 up until present times, I've been involved. I've seen it all. And before 1959, it's pretty easy to do due diligence and find out what the missing pieces are, and that's what I've done. You know, by A, working with people that lived in that time, like Wernher von Braun and others. And Wernher von Braun, by the way, did not like America.
He did.
He was a full-on Nazi. He never changed.
Wow.
He didn't believe in bombing people. He wasn't a warmonger. He wanted to go into outer space. That's what he wanted to do. Do it for America, because he hated this country. I know that for a fact. His hatred was so great that he got cancer and died from stomach cancer from his ulcers and stuff.
Did he really?
Yeah. He spent most of his time down in, the guy that I didn't mention, the guy that I, his number one henchman was a guy by the name of Wernher von Lossberg. I didn't mention him in the book. Wernher von Lossberg was a young Nazi, probably a baby in Germany. He's about my age, so he would have been born probably either at the latter part of the world or right after it. Probably at the latter part. How he got hooked up with Wernher von Braun, I never knew. But he had a whole crew of Germans that that worked for him that we had to deal with on a daily basis at Rockwell. It was terrible. These guys...
Incredible.
They wore black ski outfits, ski boots, and gold hard hats. And we all had to have our helmet, our hard hats, because when you work out in a spaceship area, you have to wear a hard hat. We had to have them painted once a week bright gold. And if you didn't have a bright gold helmet on, showing that you were part of Wernher von Braun's unit, they gave you more crap than you can imagine. I'll never forget that.
Did you ever meet him, Fred?
Yeah, lots of times.
You did?
Yeah, he was at our facilities where I worked. That's why he was my boss. Yeah, my boss would have been is that, you know, he put out engineering orders and all that kind of stuff. He had to do with what they were.
Yeah.
But the discipline of how he conducted his work was guarded. It's like you go to homeroom in the morning, and that's where von Lossberg was.
Yep.
In homeroom, they would hand out the orders for the day. I mean, it's total military, you know, inside of a company. It was run military style. And they'd hand out the orders, and we'd go out to the spaceship, the Saturn, you know, the Apollo, whatever we were working on, mostly the Saturn. And then we'd have to perform duties. At the end of the day, we'd check back in and report our progress. And if we didn't have enough progress, they'd give us crap.
You know?
Oh, yeah. They didn't mess around.
Wow.
They didn't mess around at all. And then before that, I worked for Scott Crossfield over in the SNID Space and Information Division. Mm-hmm. Scott Crossfield was the guy that flew the X-15 beyond the speed of sound a few times.
Oh.
And he was a lot of fun. I like Scott Crossfield.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an incredible story.
Yeah. So anyway, it's all going in a book.
That's fabulous.
You know, because I listen to these guys on these shows that they're people that have done a lot of book studying and internet studies. I was there, you know, and I know what. And so it's easy for me to do a little additional research and get the exact facts. And if sometimes the research isn't right because I was there, I didn't see all of it, but I visited 2,000 companies. And believe me, I got a lot of input. A lot more than most people did.
That's really incredible, Fred.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very interesting book.
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of cute, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a real expose. That's why we call it The Inside Track, Life After 2012.
Yeah.
So anyhow, you got your show tomorrow.
Yeah, I got my show on at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening, and I'm going to talk about the Andromedans and the necklace and... going to be talking about being still in your mind.
Well, that'll be good.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Should be a lot of fun. This is one heck of a book you're writing. Wow, that's really incredible because my dad used to tell me stories of WW2. He was a welder. He used to fix battleships and that kind of stuff actually New York City and Philadelphia. It used to be in the Philadelphia Navy Yard.
Oh, yeah, and, that's where the USS Eldridge has some fun.
Yes, yes.
I wish I could, but that's not going to be in my book, but I actually have a piece of gear off that ship.
That's what I heard.
Actually one of the recorders that came off the USS Eldridge in my possession.
Wow.
Believe it or not. Wow. Well, anyway, we're running out of time here. It's 6:56. Fun show once again.
Yeah, very good show, Fred.
And, but anyhow, this book, it's also going to have the most advanced things on the string theory, and it's going to show the solution to all these problems. But I want people to really understand what the problems are, who created them, and where they're going with it, okay, before I present the solutions. Solutions are in the book, but some of those are already written. I'm so tired of seeing half-assed, you know, presentations about and paranoiac explanations about creeping fascism and control and mind control. I'm presenting the facts. And anybody that wants to can research them later. And there'll be a great guide for that. Because I'm tired of seeing this, this whole thing not presented properly. So that's why I'm writing this book.
Amazing.
So I can go play music afterwards.
Yeah.
Let somebody else take over, you know. All right, well, we got to sign out now because we're going to be over time.
Okay,
but anyhow, we've had Steve Barish and Bella Bird, my co-hosts, on. You've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show, the number one show on BBS Radio, one of the fastest-growing internet shows in the world. And the archives, check the archives out. There's so much information. We'll have a lot of world-famous people on here again later on in the summer. But right now, we're covering the topic of the book. We also need to copy the work on the Planet X at some point.
Yeah.
So until tomorrow night, of course, is a canned show, and then next Saturday night we'll have to, or next Friday and Saturday we won't be here. We'll be in Los Angeles at the LA Hilton doing the Conscious Life Expo. Come and see us, and then we'll be on in 2 weeks live. Thank you very much, and we're signing out.